Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. It is September 11th, 2015, 14 years after the terrorist attacks on New York and the Pentagon, and, of course, Pennsylvania, and 3 years since the attack on Benghazi, which left 4 Americans dead. We'll touch on that a little bit towards the end of our podcast today. We begin with breaking good martini news, Jim. This from the Baltimore Sun. Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake, beleaguered by the death of Freddie Gray and the protests and rioting that followed, announced Friday she will not seek re-election. She said she is stepping out of the race to focus on, quote, work to move our city forward, and not out of any concern she might not win the race against a growing field of challengers, which now includes at least 3 other Democrats. She's 45. She says she has no other plans to seek another office. So, Jim, clearly there's nothing else going on because you can't focus on doing your job and run for re-election at the same time.
Yeah, that happens all the time, doesn't it, Greg? You know, that politicians say, yeah, I don't want another term. I'm doing fine. I feel like, you know, it's going so well for the city. I think one term of me is enough. And I'm just going to focus on my – like we may actually kind of wish that, that they'd be a little more focused on doing their jobs and less focused on winning re-election. But look, it's very hard to not interpret this as – a rebuke to her, the recognition that, look, she did take, you know, either overtly or covertly, either consciously or subconsciously, she sent the signal to the police during Baltimore's riots that if they cracked down hard on the rioters, she would not have their back, that she was willing to let them, you know, let them express their rage, give them leeway in a way that we had not seen many city officials do so before. And there's been a lot of finger pointing since then, a lot of, you know, contentions about how clear that signaling was from her. But indisputably, I mean, like, you know, the riots were terrible. And then, of course, the murder rate in Baltimore has just skyrocketed since then. And there's been debate about whether Baltimore police are, in the words of a former commissioner, taking a knee. They're basically saying, all right, we're not going to police the way we used to because we've been told that we're the villains if we do that. The result is a less safe city. Now we can pretty much conclude things in Baltimore have gotten so bad that it makes no, you know, that there's no point in her running for re-election. She would lose and she would lose badly. She has effectively been rejected by the electorate. You know who this kind of reminds me of, Greg?
Who's that?
Louisiana Governor Kathleen Blanco.
Oh, yes.
Post-Katrina, right? I mean, sometimes government fails and it's time for new leadership there. We will see where things go from there. But if you kind of feel like you have not liked the direction of the way local city officials in places like Baltimore and some other cities in this country treat the police forces, maybe up in de Blasio, up in New York, things like that, this is a push against that. This is a good indicator that this is not a philosophy that will lead you to a thriving and successful career in urban politics in the United States and today.
Well, that's hopefully a great takeaway. If, in fact, that's the lesson learned, and we'll see how the candidates respond in Baltimore and other races that have seen violence in their cities. All right, on to the bad martini now. And speaking of government ineptness, let's move to the federal level. And of course, whether it's healthcare.gov or the VA, which we talked about recently, we've seen plenty of government incompetence, but we've seen it again in a slightly unsettling area, to say the least. This from the USA Today version of the story from Thursday. The Pentagon's most secure laboratories may have mislabeled, improperly stored, and shipped samples of potentially infectious plague bacteria, which can cause several deadly forms of disease, USA Today has learned. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention flagged the practices after inspections last month at an Army lab in Maryland, one of the Pentagon's most secure labs. That helped prompt an emergency ban on research on all bioterror pathogens at 9 laboratories run by the Pentagon, which was already reeling from revelations that another Army lab in Utah had mishandled anthrax samples for 10 years. Jim, what can we trust the government to get right here?
Yeah. You know why you're supposed to be very careful handling the plague?
Why?
Because you're supposed to avoid it like the plague. Right? I mean, when the very name of the substance, like it's as if the name death was taken, although they used to call it the Black Death. So thankfully, it doesn't sound like anyone's been harmed by this. But on top of the, you know, mishandling of other, you know, infectious disease samples and things like that, it's just particularly unnerving. And you just don't want to get out of bed Greg, I'm going back to bed. I'm going under the covers. I'm just not dealing with the world when you see news like this.
Here's the reassurance, though, Jim. Officials point out that continuing testing has shown the suspect samples of plague contain a weakened version and not the fully virulent form that was of concern to lab regulators to the CDC. So, pshaw, it's just a weakened form of the plague.
It's diet plague, Greg. It's plague zero. It's got like half the calories. It's really barely going to affect you. It's like the light beer of plague.
All right. On to the crazy martini now. And there's when you first hear news like this, Jim, you think, oh, good. People we hate each other, too. And maybe they'll focus on killing each other rather than us and our allies. But there's also a darker twist to this story, you have to think. ABC News, just ahead of the 14th anniversary of Al-Qaeda's 9/11 attacks on the U.S., the leader of the terrorist group took aim in an angry speech at a mortal enemy, but not American crusaders this time. Rather, the object of his tirade was the leader of ISIS in a declaration of war that will irreconcilably divide the two terror groups in a way the U.S. may be able to exploit. Ayman al-Zawahiri, who replaced Osama bin Laden, in a new audio message accused ISIS top leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi of sedition and insisted the Iraqi terrorist recluse was not the leader of all Muslims and militant jihad as caliph of the Islamic State, as Baghdadi claimed 14 months ago. So the more you dig into this, it's not like Zawahiri's out there saying, whoa, these ISIS guys, they're just going too far here. It's just basically a radical Muslim spitting match of who wants to control this imaginary caliphate.
As much as you'd like, this is where you see Al-Qaeda declares war on ISIS, and you feel like, should we feel good about this? This is the foreign policy equivalent of aliens versus predator. Whoever wins, we lose. If there's an opportunity to exploit this, terrific. But it's not, as you point out, it's not really that Al-Qaeda has decided, whoa, where did these guys get the idea that terror attacks are okay? We're waiting for ISIS to have that scene from the old PSA commercial. I learned it from watching you. This kind of generational divide in crazy Islamist terrorists. Look, if one will rat out the other or others, they'll expend resources fighting each other, fantastic. Ultimately, they are two different strains of the same evil ideology. And as I think you acknowledge, this is really much more about ego and who gets to be in charge. And again, it's kind of strange to see this as we approach the 9/11 anniversary. I do think it's kind of interesting that at some point the object of our fear, there's an interesting argument of whether we have actually defeated Al-Qaeda functionally. Bin Laden is dead. Mullah Omar, we now know, is dead. He was leader of the Taliban at the time. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is sitting in Gitmo. Zawahiri's still out there, but you don't hear quite as much. You hear about Al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula and Yemen and places like that. But ISIS, with its theatrical format of killing people and its seizure of territory in Syria and in Iraq, really does seem to be what keeps us up late at night. And I don't know whether that's a sign of a changing of the guard or a sign that we've kind of lost the ball on Al-Qaeda, or whether Al-Qaeda really has been eroded to the point where it's not the premier terror threat in the world anymore. If so, a lot of people deserve congratulations for that. But I just got to tell you, on the one hand, here it is, it's a little bit after 11 o'clock on Eastern Standard Time. No reports of attacks on our embassies or attacks on Americans abroad so far. Maybe this will be a quiet September 11th. And if so, thank God. But just an overall sense that, look, we all know this ideology is still thriving, still growing out there. And, question of are we good or are we lucky? And if so, well, how long will our luck hold out?
Well, you made a very good point there that it's not just 9/11 2001 that we remember, because there have been attacks on our installations, on our people and on our friends on other 9/11s, most notably Benghazi in 2012. And so we remember Stevens and Smith and Doherty and Woods today, in addition to all those lost in various forms, New York, D.C., Pennsylvania, on the plains and so forth on 9/11. Kudos to the networks, the cable networks, for spending a lot of time on this today. MSNBC, our one kudos a year for them for replaying entirely the Today Show from that morning in real time. And people just don't show the attacks and the visceral reaction that we had to it at the time. And it's good that they do it at least once. They should probably do it a little bit more.
I've been thinking about that again more and more today. And I as I wrote in the Morning Jolt today, Greg, that I'm starting to understand how the Greatest Generation probably felt on December 7th, 1955, that I'm sure at that point there probably was remembrance, there were ceremonies, but life had largely gone on from World War II, and people were moving on from that. And you see millennials, you see walking my kids off to the school bus stop. For a certain number of people, this is now part of history. And I think for those of us who lived through it, boy, it feels like it was yesterday. You know, it's very vivid. It's right there. And we, on the one hand, we kind of need life to go on. We should not live in fear. We should not be having traumatic flashbacks on one day of the year. But there is kind of this sense of like, well, wait a second. At some point, do our lives get too normal? At some point, do we kind of are we doing something wrong by not focusing on it today? I mean, on that day in September 14 years ago, we thought life was never going to be the same. And it's strange to see normality on a day that we always thought was never, you know, that date was never going to be the same ever again. So just a lot of thoughts going through our heads on a day like today, Greg.
Yeah, and the history you mentioned is very interesting. There are now college freshmen, most college freshmen, I would say, this year were 4 years old on 9/11. So they might have distant, fuzzy memories of it, particularly if they had someone involved. I'm sure the memories are even clearer. But in years going forward, well, our college generation and everybody younger is going to only know this through the stories that we tell and through the things that they read, because they don't remember it. And it seems like yesterday to those of us who do remember it vividly, but more and more over time, it just shows you how fast time goes and how over time more and more people don't remember it. And it's up to the rest of us to make sure they understand what happened and why we keep fighting. Jim, we'll pause there. Sober note to end the week, but an appropriate one. And we'll pick it up again on Monday. Have a good weekend. Talk to you then.
See you Monday, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Monday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.